One of the action shots showed two men with a young girl between them. The girl was not much more than a child. She was holding both men's hands, smiling gaily, leading them down a street in a city. Paris, almost certainly. The caption underneath the picture said, Béatrice de service à ses travaux. Beatrice on duty, doing her work. Beatrice looked to be about 13 years old. I was pretty sure Beatrice was my mother. I flipped back to the pages of studio portraits and found her. It was some kind of a school photograph. She looked to be about 16 in it. The caption was Beatrice en 1947, Beatrice in 1947. I flipped back and forth through the text and pieced together Le Monnier's narrative thesis. There were two main tactical problems with the human railroad. Finding the downed airmen was not one of them. They fell out of the sky, literally, all over the Low Countries, dozens of them every moonless night. If the resistance got to them first, they stood a chance. If the Wehrmacht got to them first, they didn't. It was a matter of pure luck. If they got lucky and the resistance got to them ahead of the Germans, they'd be hidden out, their uniforms would be exchanged for some kind of plausible disguises, forged papers would be issued, rail tickets would be bought, and a courier would escort them on a train to Paris, and they'd be on their way home. Maybe. The first tactical problem was the possibility of a spot check on the train itself, sometime during the initial journey. These were blonde, corn-fed farm boys from America, or red-headed British boys from Scotland, or anything else that didn't look dark and pinched and wartime French. They stood out. They didn't speak the language. Lots of subterfuges were developed. They would pretend to be asleep, or sick, or mute, or deaf. The couriers would do all the talking. The second tactical problem was transiting Paris itself. Paris was crawling with Germans. There were random checkpoints everywhere. Clumsy lost foreigners stuck out like sore thumbs. Private cars had disappeared completely. Taxis were hard to find. There was no gasoline. Men walking in the company of other men became targets. So women were used as couriers. And then one of the dodges Le Monnier dreamed up was to use a kid he knew. She would meet airmen at the Gare du Nord and lead them through the streets to the Gare de Lyon. She would laugh and skip and hold their hands and pass them off as older brothers or visiting uncles. Her manner was unexpected and disarming. She got people through checkpoints like ghosts. She was 13 years old. Everyone in the chain had code names. Hers was Beatrice. Le Monnier's was Pierre. I took the blue cardboard jewel case out of the box, opened it up. Inside was a medal. It was La Médaille de la Résistance, the resistance medal. It had a fancy red, white, and blue ribbon, and the medal itself was gold. I turned it over. On the back it was neatly engraved. Joséphine Moutier. My mother.
She never told you?
Summer said. I shook my head. Not a word. Not one. Ever. Then I looked back in the box. What the hell was the garotte about? Call Joe, I said. Tell him we're coming over. Tell him to get Le Monnier back there. We were at the apartment 15 minutes later. Le Monnier was already there. Maybe he'd never left. I gave the box to Joe and told him to check it out. He was faster than I'd been, because he started with the medal. The name on the back gave him a clue. He glanced through the book and looked up at Le Monnier, when he recognized him in the author photograph. Then he scanned through the text, looked at the pictures, looked at me. "She ever mention any of this to you?" he said. "Never." "You?" "Never," he said. I looked at Le Monnier. "What was the garotte for?" Le Monnier said nothing. "Tell us," I said.
She was found out,
he said,
by a boy at her school, a boy of her own age, an unpleasant boy, the son of collaborators. He teased and tormented her about what he was going to do.
What did he do?
At first, nothing. That was extremely unsettling for your mother. Then he demanded certain indignities as the price of his continued silence. Naturally, your mother refused. He told her he would inform on her. So she pretended to relent. She arranged to meet him under the Pont des Invalides late one night. She had to slip out of her house. But first, she took her mother's cheese cutter from the kitchen. She replaced the wire with a string from her father's piano. It was the G below middle C, I think. It was still missing, years later. She met the boy, and she strangled him.
She what? Joe said.
She strangled him.
She was 13 years old. Lemonnier nodded.
At that age, the physical differences between girls and boys are not a significant handicap.
She was 13 years old and she killed a guy?
They were desperate times.
What exactly happened, I said.
She used the garrote, as she had planned. It's not a difficult instrument to use. Nerve and determination were all she needed. Then she used the original cheese wire to attach a weight to his belt. She slipped him into the Seine. He was gone, and she was safe. The human railroad was safe.
Joe stared at him. You let her do that? Lemonnier shrugged, an expressive Gallic shrug, just like my mother's.
I didn't know about it, he said. She didn't tell me until afterwards. I suppose at first my instinct would have been to forbid it, but I couldn't have taken care of it myself. I had no legs. I couldn't have climbed down under the bridge, and I wouldn't have been steady enough for fighting. I had a man loosely employed as an assassin, but he was busy elsewhere. In Belgium, I think. I couldn't have afforded the risk of waiting for him to get back. So, on balance, I think I would have told her to go ahead. They were desperate times, and we were doing vital work.
Did this really happen? Joe said.
I know it did,
Lemonnier said.
Fish ate through the boy's belt. He floated up some days later, a short distance downstream. We passed a nervous week, but nothing came of it.
How long did she work for you? I asked.
All through 1943, he said. She was extremely good, but her face became well known. At first, her face was her guardian. It was so young and so innocent. How could anyone suspect a face like that? Then it became a liability. She became familiar to Les Boches. And how many brothers and cousins and uncles could one girl have? So I had to stand her down.
Did you recruit her?
She volunteered. She pestered me until I let her help.
How many people did she save?
80 men.
Lemonnier said.
She was my best Paris courier. She was a phenomenon. The consequences of discovery didn't bear thinking about. She lived with the worst kind of fear in her gut for a whole year, but never once did she let me down.
We all sat quiet. How did you start? I asked.
I was a war cripple,
he said.
One of many. We were too medically burdensome for them to want us as hostage prisoners. We were useless as forced laborers, so they left us in Paris. But I wanted to do something. I wasn't physically capable of fighting, but I could organize. Those are not physical skills. I knew that trained bomber crews were worth their weight in gold, so I decided to get them home.
Why would my mother go her whole life without mentioning this stuff? Lemonnier shrugged again. Weary, unsure, still mystified, all those years later.
Many reasons, I think,
he said.
France was a conflicted country in 1945. Many had resisted, many had collaborated, many had done neither. Most preferred a clean slate. And she was ashamed of killing the boy, I think. It weighed on her conscience. I told her it hadn't been a choice. It wasn't a voluntary action. I told her it had been the right thing to do. But she preferred to forget the whole thing. I had to beg her to accept her medal.
Joe and I and Summer said nothing. We all sat quiet.
I wanted her sons to know,
Lemonnier said. Summer and I walked back to the hotel. We didn't talk. I felt like a guy who suddenly finds out he was adopted. You're not the man I thought you were. All my life, I had assumed I was what I was because of my father, the career Marine. Now I felt different genes stirring. My father hadn't killed the enemy at the age of 13, but my mother had. She had lived through desperate times, and she had stepped up and done what was necessary. At that moment, I started to miss her more than I would have thought possible. At that moment, I knew I would miss her forever. I felt empty. I had lost something I never knew I had. We carried our bags down to the lobby and checked out at the desk. We gave back our keys, and the multilingual girl prepared a long and detailed account. I had to countersign it. I knew I was in trouble as soon as I saw it. It was outrageously expensive. I had figured the Army might overlook the forged vouchers in exchange for a result, but now I wasn't so sure. I figured the George Sank tariff might change their view. It was like adding insult to injury. We'd been there one night, but we were being charged for two because we were late checking out. My room service coffee cost as much as a meal in a bistro. My phone call to Rock Creek cost as much as a three-course lunch at the best restaurant in town. My phone call to friends in California cost as much as a five-course dinner. Summer's call to Joe, less than a mile away in my mother's apartment, asking him to get hold of Lemonnier, was billed at less than 2 minutes and cost as much as the room service coffee. And we'd been charged fees for taking incoming calls. One was from Franz to me, and the other was from Joe to Summer, when he asked her to check I was okay. That little piece of sibling consideration was going to cost the government $5. Altogether, it was the worst hotel bill I'd ever seen. The multilingual girl printed two copies. I signed one for her, and she folded the other into an embossed George Sank envelope and gave it to me. For my records, she said. For my court-martial, I thought. I put it in my inside jacket pocket, took it out again about 6 hours later, when I finally realized who had done what and to who. And why, and how. We made the familiar trek to the Place de l'Opéra and caught the airport bus. It was my sixth time on that bus in about a week. The sixth time was no more comfortable than the previous five. It was the discomfort that started me thinking. We got out at International Departures and found the Air France ticket desk. Swapped two vouchers for two seats to Dulles on the 11 o'clock red-eye. That gave us a long wait. We humped our bags across the concourse and started out in a bar. Summer wasn't conversational. I guess she couldn't think of anything to say. But the truth was, I was doing okay at that point. Life was unfolding the same way it always had for everyone. Sooner or later, you ended up an orphan. There was no escaping it. It had happened that way for 1,000 generations. No point in getting all upset about it. We drank bottles of beer and looked for somewhere to eat. I'd missed breakfast and lunch, and I guessed Summer hadn't eaten either. We walked past all the little tax-exempt boutiques and found a place that was made up to look like a sidewalk bistro. We pooled our few remaining dollars and checked the menu and worked out that we could afford one course each, plus juice for her and coffee for me, and a tip for the waiter. We ordered steak frites, which turned out to be a decent slab of meat with shoestring fries and mayonnaise. You could get good food anywhere in France, even an airport.